From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Rush Limbaugh, the Republican Party, and women. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. It's been more than a week since Rush Limbaugh called a law student a slut and a prostitute during his radio show, but the uproar's not over. Limbaugh is losing sponsors, the president's been asked about him, and Republicans are on the defensive about their popularity with women. The top three presidential candidates have said very little, and some conservative writers have said Republicans are afraid of arousing Limbaugh's animosity. With an audience of 15 million devoted listeners, how much do his views and opinions reflect those of the GOP as a whole? On Reporter's Notebook later on, New York police surveillance of Muslims outside the city. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Since Rush Limbaugh attacked a law student as a slut and a prostitute, Democrats have accused Republicans of being insensitive to women's rights and issues. How much clout does Limbaugh have with the GOP? Do candidates really fear him? On Reporter's Notebook, in schools, businesses, internet cafes, and mosques, the New York police are watching Muslim Americans even outside the city. Is it appropriate protection against another September 11th or a violation of civil rights? First, this news update. In Washington, there's dispute about whether the U.S. should provide air cover for Syrian dissidents being mowed down by the army of President Bashar al-Assad. Senators John McCain and John Kerry, a Republican and a Democrat, have opposing views.
I understand the strain on American military. I understand the sacrifices made by American families. But I also understand that the proudest part of Americans' history is when we have tried to help other people achieve the same goals that we so passionately articulated when we declared our independence.
I think you have to lay some groundwork here. I mean, the United States can't just jump up one morning and say, okay, let's go drop some bombs on Syrian tanks.
As the dispute goes on in Washington, a video posted on YouTube appears to show a high-ranking Syrian official announcing that he has defected and joined what he calls the revolution of this dignified people. Liz Sly is based in Beirut, Lebanon, for The Washington Post. And Liz Sly, it's always good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, thank you.
How certain are we that this man is who he says he is?
Well, there's no reason really to disbelieve that he is who he says he is. It's difficult to confirm, and without being able to get hold of him directly, and in the absence of the confirmation of Syrian officials, we can't say for sure. But it doesn't smell like a fake. It doesn't seem that anybody's trying to pull any wool over anybody with this, partly because he's not significant enough an official for it to be something that would be significant enough to fake or to lie about.
Who is he, or who does he say he is?
Well, he says he's the deputy oil minister. They actually use the word assistant oil minister, which makes you wonder if he's an assistant or a deputy minister. But he is named on the Ministry of Oil's website, but that in itself doesn't necessarily make him particularly close to the center of decision-making either. The government, such as the government is in Syria, does not have that much power. So whilst it's symbolically very significant, I don't know at this early stage whether we can say that, you know, it's a very significant defection.
He says this: I have been in government for 33 years. I did not want to end my career serving the crimes of this regime. I have preferred to do what is right, although I know this regime will burn my house and persecute my family. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, says this is an important moment.
Well, it's important because we have not seen any government officials actually breaking with the regime and announcing it. One can only imagine that it speaks to a level of greater disaffection within perhaps many of the government officials serving under the regime who don't dare to make this move because, as he points out in the video, there would be repercussions for it. So to the extent that it proves something we've suspected but have not been able to ascertain, that there is a disaffection even within the regime with the behavior of the top officials, then to that extent, yes, it is important.
Now, at the same time, a top UN relief official, Valerie Amos, is touring Bab Amour, the neighborhood that was so devastated by Syrian forces. Do we know what she's finding?
What she's told us, that there are very few comments that have come out, but what she's told us that it is completely devastated, which we kind of know because there has been footage of this released both by activists and by government state television, that the area is completely devastated and that most people have fled.
So it's an empty place now. What does she intend to do, or what has she indicated the UN ought to do?
Well, it's very unclear at this point whether the UN can do anything. Anybody who goes to Syria, as the Arab League has found, as we journalists who've been there have found, and as we know with the International Committee of the Red Cross being kept out of Bab Amour for the past week, all movement there is closely supervised by government officials. The kind of freedom of movement you'd need to actually aid the civilians in distress just doesn't exist. But this will come at a time when I think the U.S. and Europe have realized that because they're making no progress on the political front because of Russia and China's determination to veto resolutions at the U.N. Security Council, that they want to press on the one issue that it's really hard to deny, which is the humanitarian suffering.
Very quickly, back to the defection or apparent defection. Has the Free Syrian Army or other dissidents had much to say about that?
The head of the opposition welcomed the defection. He said he hoped other officials would follow. We are hearing some unconfirmed reports that there have been further military defections today, and I think the hope of the opposition is that if the door cracks open a little bit, more will flood through.
Liz Sly in Beirut for The Washington Post, as always. Thanks very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, Rush Limbaugh, the Republican Party, and women on To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Rush Limbaugh insists that reports of advertiser defection have been exaggerated, but liberal groups say he's taking a lot of hits. It's all about Limbaugh's attack on Georgetown law student Sandra Fluke, who testified on Capitol Hill about the need for health insurers to provide birth control to liberate women for the workforce and protect against disease.
I think another impact that it's really important that we all think about is that contraception, when it first became available, was a revolution in this country. It allowed women to enter employment and educational opportunities that had previously not been accessible because they were unable to control their reproduction in the same way. And I just can't imagine rolling back the clock on that progress.
And here's how Limbaugh started the controversy.
What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex? What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute. She wants to be paid to have sex. She's having so much sex she can't afford the contraception. She wants you and me and the taxpayers to pay her to have sex. What does that make us? We're the pimps.
Again, Rush Limbaugh in the aftermath of the statement before a Democratic committee on Capitol Hill. Jim Rainey is media writer for the Los Angeles Times. He's written about this. And Jim Rainey, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
How did this come about, and what sort of reaction has there been? This has been going on for more than a week.
Yes. These things that they sometimes do take on a life of their own. They become their kind of own ecosystem. And on both sides, you've got a huge outpouring of people on the right who are defending Limbaugh, and they like to go back and cite the many cases of the Bill Maher's and the Ed Schultz's and folks on the left who have made insulting comments about women. And then on the left, you've got people, Media Matters and other groups that are really beating the drum to pull ads from Limbaugh's show. So it's these things you think are going to die down, but they always have another half-life. When you think it's going to be over, it's got at least three or four more days in it.
Took a lot of attention away from the Super Tuesday primaries.
Yeah, and it sort of got wrapped up in Super Tuesday, too, because all the candidates were being asked to react, and they had quite a tepid reaction to what Mr. Limbaugh did. In fact, it seemed somewhat amazing that Rick Santorum, who's very conservative, of course, and a Bible-centered candidate, I think he himself would say, but he said this was just Rush being an entertainer and kind of being silly, so he didn't really want to call him on the carpet, and neither did any of the other major candidates.
We'll hear a bit from all of them just a little bit later. There have been those, George Will and others, who have said that, in fact, the Republican candidates and the Republican Party in general is fearful of Rush Limbaugh because he has such a devoted following and because he's so strong in his views. Do we have any indication that that might be true?
Well, I think it's clear that this is someone with a big audience and a lot of clout. His audience, he likes to say it's 20 million cumulatively for a week. The industry trade group that monitors this says maybe 15 million. Whatever the number is, it's clearly large enough that it has a lot of people's attention on both sides. And just one quick example, there was a profile done of Rush in which he went to the White House when George Bush was still in power and was served a birthday cake by the president himself, who then joined a small group there, and they sang happy birthday to Rush. So there aren't a lot of folks in the media who get a personal audience with the president and have a rendition of happy birthday. So, yes, he has a lot of clout.
It's apparently very complicated to determine who's right and who's wrong, but there are those who are saying that Rush Limbaugh has lost a lot of advertisers. There's, of course, an enormous media campaign on Twitter, quoting JCPenney and other advertisers as well. What's your take on how hard this has hit him economically?
Well, I think there's clearly been some impact, and he's arguing every day. In fact, he opened his show again today saying that this was just a trifle and that it was being exaggerated. He took on a Washington Post reporter on a specific example they used about a new advertiser who supposedly had come to him. It's very hard to measure. I've talked to a couple experts on the radio industry, and they just said it's going to be hard to tell. Media Matters, on the other hand, just put up a new post just minutes ago, and it includes from WABC, his affiliate in New York, it includes 1 minute of dead air that they say had to be go unfilled because Rush has lost so many advertisers.
You said Rush Limbaugh had a birthday party at the White House. President Obama was asked about this flap in his news conference this week.
I don't know what's in Rush Limbaugh's heart, so I'm not going to comment on the sincerity of his apology. What I can comment on is the fact that all decent folks can agree that the remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse.
Now, in subsequent broadcasts after the initial assault, Limbaugh himself has apologized, saying that he had used the wrong language when he made those statements about the young woman. As the controversy has continued, Limbaugh has sort of rearranged his apology.
In fighting them on this issue last week, I became like them. Against my own instincts, against my own knowledge, against everything I know to be right and wrong, I descended to their level.
John Wilson is author of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. John Wilson, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here.
Obviously, you are not a fan of Rush Limbaugh. How do you interpret his changing apology as time has gone on? And do you think he's been hurt where he can be hurt most, and that is in the loss of advertisers?
Well, certainly this has hit Rush in his only sensitive part, which is his wallet. And that has hit him. It hasn't necessarily hit him personally because he has a contract where he makes a lot of money. Enormous amounts of money. He was paid $38 million a year and got a $100 million signing bonus for his latest contract. So he's not going to personally go to the poorhouse over this. But it is going to hurt his prestige. It's going to hurt him next contract. It does affect him. It's something he's deeply concerned with. Rush Limbaugh has been a master of gathering advertisers, meeting with them personally, selecting the advertisers he wants on his show. So this is unprecedented in his entire career that advertisers would abandon him. It's never been done on this scale. And although most of the advertisers leaving him are from the local markets, the advertisers he doesn't control who advertise with each of his individual radio stations, this is still, he has lost some of his own advertisers, and it's still very disturbing, I'm sure, to him.
What about his clout with the Republican Party? When you call him the most dangerous man in America, is that part of what you're talking about?
Well, yes, actually, that's something that Ronald Reagan wrote to him. It's something that Rush Limbaugh sort of said about himself from his critics. But it's actually in a note in 1989 that Ronald Reagan wrote to him, calling him the most dangerous man in America, and that shows the kind of influence he has, how he has the praise of these leading Republicans and the fear of many of the Republicans to criticize him. Back in 2009, there were so many Republicans actually apologizing to Rush Limbaugh when they even dared to moderately criticize him that the Democratic Party created a website called I'm Sorry, Rush, to document these cases and provide a convenient way for Republicans to apologize. So there is this, I think, this fear, not only a fear, though, of Rush's listeners and the idea of Rush criticizing potentially Republicans who dare to disobey him, but there's a widespread agreement, I think, between the Republican Party and a lot of Rush Limbaugh's very conservative values, and so I think that reluctance is not just a reluctance to face the wrath of Rush and his listeners. It's also reluctance based on a general agreement with these kind of right-wing ideology that he has.
When you say, though, when you use the title the most dangerous man in America, you meant it in a very different way than Ronald Reagan did. He meant it ironically, did he not, saying he was the most dangerous man in America, meaning that he's going to shake up the establishment that Reagan himself was running against. You're taking it more seriously.
Well, no, I think I mean it in the same way, that he is dangerous because he is so influential, because he has really helped shift the conservative movement and the Republican Party not only in a more right-wing direction, but also in a deeply anti-intellectual direction. And so he is someone who is very much distrustful of science and medicine and academia and has really put those values out that are now much more prevalent among the Republican Party, which at one time, for example, on climate change, you had George W. Bush and many Republicans embracing it. It's really Rush Limbaugh who's led the move for the Republican Party to reject the science about climate change.
Okay. This, of course, involves his views with regard to women, at least one woman, and we're going to find out how far that might go. The influential conservative columnist George Will has accused Republicans of being afraid of Rush Limbaugh. So has David Frum. He's a former White House speechwriter for George W. Bush. Here's what the top three presidential candidates have said about Limbaugh's attack on Sandra Fluke.
Well, he's being absurd. But that's, an entertainer can be absurd.
You know, David, I am astonished at the desperation of the elite media and to suddenly decide that Rush Limbaugh is the great national crisis of this week.
It's not the language I would have used.
That last one was Mitt Romney, just a very brief statement from him. That's not the language I would have used. That's what Rush Limbaugh said himself at the beginning. The in-between, you hear Newt Gingrich attacking what he refers to as the elite media for making a case of this. It was Rick Santorum who said that this was all absurd, that Rush Limbaugh had been absurd. Mona Charon is a syndicated columnist, political analyst. She's a contributor to the National Review Online. Mona Charon, good to have you on our program.
Hi, nice to be here.
Can you defend Rush Limbaugh?
Well, I can certainly defend the point of view that he was very maladroitly attempting to express. We can all agree that what he said was inappropriate, repellent, and he's apologized for it, as he should have. But, this is one huge subject change, it seems to me, from what we really ought to be discussing, which is that the Obama administration has come up with a plan that is neither economically nor morally nor constitutionally sound to provide another huge freebie to another class of people who don't need it, right? Namely, middle class and wealthy women who can very well buy their own birth control. It's very inexpensive, $9 a month at Target for pills, or even less for condoms. widely available. The government spends $300 million to give it out to people who don't have insurance. Everybody on Medicaid gets it as part of their package of benefits. It is utterly and completely unnecessary, but the Obama administration decided that it had to be given out to all women in America. Why? As a transparent attempt to win the votes of women voters in the upcoming election. I don't know why they didn't announce that they want to give out free cancer medications. I mean, there you could say, well, those people are really unfortunate. You know, young, healthy women do not need this. And furthermore, it violates the strictures of the Catholic Church, and forcing Catholics to provide it violates First Amendment, in my judgment. But anyway, because one talk show host made a rude and crude comment, similar in nature to rude and crude comments that we've heard from many people on the left about Sarah Palin and many other women, about Laura Ingraham. Very crude, even much cruder things were said about conservative women. And it didn't become a week-long discussion about their rudeness. I mean, that's a real side issue. He apologized. He was rude. He was, in the wrong. He apologized. But let's get back to discussing what's really important here, which is this really unprecedented and unnecessary contraceptive mandate on the part of the Obama administration.
What about what Sandra Fluke said about contraception liberating the women so that they could enter employment? And then we didn't hear it on this program, but she went into some detail about how the use of contraceptives is important to protect against some very important diseases.
Well, fine. So is every medicine. Should we provide all medicines for free? I mean, this notion of, this is important to me, therefore somebody else has to buy it for me. I can't take care of myself. I'm not a sentient, self-reliant adult member of the population. Somebody has to take care of me, make me a ward of the state. There are lots of things that women need in order to participate in the public square. They need a roof over their heads. They need good, wholesome food to eat. Lots of times they need transportation. Why doesn't the government propose that we provide all of those things for free, too, from the government, so-called free? Of course, there is no free lunch.
Again, Mona Charon is a syndicated columnist and political analyst, contributor to the National Review Online. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation with, among others, the chair of Republicans for Choice. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, New York police surveillance of Muslims outside the city. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about Rush Limbaugh and the Republican Party. Rush Limbaugh, a man who was given a birthday party at the White House by George W. Bush, a man he tried to get elected, criticized, although somewhat gently, by the successor president, Obama, as we just heard a few moments ago. Let me go back to Jim Rainey, our media writer for the Los Angeles Times. Mona Charon said a moment ago that the Democrats have seized on this in a way that she finds to be inappropriate, particularly given what Democrats have said from time to time or liberals have said from time to time about Republicans. She claims in the same vein. Tell us what David Axelrod, one of the president's principal political advisors, had to say about this.
Well, I think there's, you can slice this so many different ways. Have we talked about this too much? You've got, on the one hand, you've got the example of Ed Schultz brought up, who insulted, used the same term, slut, talking about Laura Ingraham. Well, that was talked about and discussed for some time, probably not as much as this, I would concede. He's not, of course, nearly as big and as prominent a figure in the media. He was suspended for a week and called Ingraham and apologized. So there's clearly, on the left, there are folks who are taking advantage, or I believe it was Rahm Emanuel himself once said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think that's true on both sides of the spectrum here. One group wants to fight this on the ground of women's rights and what Rush said and did and the righteousness or lack thereof of that. And the other side wants to talk about specifically the president's policy and whether that's right or wrong. And That's where your discussion here is caught right now between those two poles.
And Bill Maher is getting a lot of attention because of things he said about Sarah Palin, as we heard from Mona Charon a moment ago. And David Axelrod, again, the president's principal political advisor, borrowed George Will's line about the Republicans being afraid of Limbaugh. So the Democrats are trying to take advantage of this, are they not?
Well, they absolutely are, and they've got them. I think you do have someone like a Santorum in an awkward position when he is so conservative in terms of, you know, his moral view of the world and of the media. And here you've got someone calling a young woman, whether you like her views or not, calling her a slut and a prostitute. I have a feeling that if that was said about one of his daughters or about his wife, he would have a different reaction than this sort of, well, boys will be boys, he's just an entertainer sort of reaction. So clearly, you know, the folks, Mr. Axelrod and the people who are against Rush Limbaugh are going to continue to keep this campaign going because they think they've hit a real weak spot for him. And he hasn't, among other things, he has lost some advertisers. Clear Channel hasn't suspended him as some others have been suspended for this kind of language. So I would think people are going to continue to try and make hay out of the issue.
James Rainey again. Jim Rainey, media writer for the Los Angeles Times. We heard a moment ago from Mona Charon, who's still with us, a conservative Republican woman, writes for the National Review Online. Ann Stone is a political strategist and activist, and she is chair of Republicans for Choice. Ann Stone, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Where do you come down on all this?
Well, unfortunately, Rush once again steps in it and drags the party along with him. The problem here, and I want to start out by saying one piece of agreement with what Mona said, and that is misogyny is not a partisan thing. Both sides have had their problems. And Maher, I have personal experience with Bill Maher and misogyny, so, you know, it isn't a partisan thing. But when Rush talks, because he has such a large viewership and because the media and others are so focused on him, it does create extraordinary problems for our party. And in this case, you know, if it had just been him, it might have blown over by now. But he was part of a confluence of, you know, comments and activities and events that all make the party look so bad when it comes to dealing with women in the modern world. And that's really why this has become an echo chamber, and it continues, because it's just reinforcing things one after another. You had the Bayer aspirin comment, you had the no women on the panel comment, you had the other attacks on Fluke and things that were said, and then Rush compounding it, you know, because he has such a large microphone. So it just is, once again, the party, which I like to think is gender blind, and that's why they didn't think to put women testifying, that I think we've now become gender stupid, that they just don't understand this modern world. You've got to think bigger than this, and you have to make an extra effort to include a female perspective, because we really do have different life experience and a different voice. And even though this may have been a panel just on religious activity and religious, the First Amendment rights, still, having women there with a woman's perspective, even on that issue, would have been helpful. But the party just doesn't think that way, and we're paying the price.
So,
and I think this... go ahead.
Well, no, I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, I think this goes beyond this, and I do want to disagree with Mona on a couple points, and that is, I think this issue over contraception has three parts to it. The first is medical, and I disagree with her. There are real reasons that even healthy women need this. There's a variety of things ranging from acne and regulation of periods to the other sort of protectant properties that contraception can have. On economic, that actually studies show that inclusion actually lowers healthcare costs. So insurance companies are really being stupid if they don't have it in there as part of their package. And we're talking about access to contraception, not necessarily just giving it free. And it also does give women more control over their lives and allows them to participate better in our economy, which we're a key force in the economy, and there's no dispute of that. But the third is a question of fairness, too. You know, if you're going to cover Viagra and if you're going to cover vasectomies and things like that, why shouldn't contraception be covered as well? It really is a question of fairness. So I think you have the medical aspects, you have economic, and you have a fairness question. And again, my party, God bless them, I really think it is gender blindness, but it is now approaching gender stupid, because they need to learn. We've stumbled so many times, you think they would have learned by now.
Mona Charon, what's your response to that?
Okay, let me take Anne's points one by one. Regarding that this is a medical need, first of all, nobody is arguing about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, or whether women should or shouldn't have, you know, should take birth control pills or use any other form of birth control. What we're arguing about is whether the state should mandate that every insurance carrier in the country and every employer provide it free of charge, no copays. That's what the administration has demanded. In the old days, insurance companies used to be able to decide, and employers decide, what kinds of packages of benefits they were going to provide. In many cases, birth control was a part of that package, and in almost all cases, birth control pills that were prescribed for medical reasons, such as irregular periods or other problems, were definitely covered because it wasn't just for a birth control purpose. Second, the notion that this is going to lower healthcare costs, I think, is completely bogus. The insurance companies would have been clever enough to figure that out if it were the case. But in point of fact, 95% of the women who need birth control are already using it and already paying for it themselves without too much hardship, by the way, because, as I mentioned, it's very inexpensive in most cases. The notion that that this will prevent unwanted pregnancies, I think, is misguided. I think that most of the women, if you look at the surveys, most of the women who get pregnant do so not because they were unable to afford birth control, but because they were too irresponsible to use it. Finally, you confused two issues. You said this isn't about providing it free. It's about access. No, it's not. It's not at all about access. It's totally about providing it free of charge, and there's only one reason. You know, The Secretary of HHS, Ms. Sebelius, and the President of the United States, you know, did not sit down in a room and say, let's think about the population that is most in dire need of free medical care of some kind, and let's give it to them. If they had done that, they might have come up with, you know, people who need chemotherapy medications or diabetics who need insulin or some other group. But no, they chose to give away, and therefore we will all pay for it, contraceptives. Why did they do that? It's not, there is no national need for women to get free stuff from the government. This is a straight middle-class welfare move on the part of a liberal Democratic administration that is trying to buy votes.
And Stone, what do you say to that?
What I say is that if my party was being smarter about it, what they would have simply said, first of all, they would have let her testify, even if it was a little off issue. And they would have said, you know what, since Target and Walmart and others provide a very low cost per month, we know that people are going to be able to take care of that, and maybe better advertising about the contraception, low cost contraception that's available will suffice. But they didn't handle it that way. They run in the other direction, or they say dumb things. And again, it's not just on this issue. It's on a variety of issues dealing with women. We just are so bad at talking to women. It really is very sad, and that's why the gap still remains. In terms of, you know, contraception being effective or not, that's a whole other question of education. Yes, you're right that a lot of birth control pills are either misused because people don't understand how to properly take medication. I've got a whole lot of stories on that. And the fact that it's such a low-dose pill now, you have to follow the directions very closely. And if you've ever seen the directions for birth control pills, it's, you know, it's a billboard-sized piece of paper in two-point type. And doctors often don't go over this stuff with their patients, or the patients say, oh, no, we know how to do it, and then go out and misuse it. So there should be more emphasis actually on other kinds of contraception that would be even more effective. That's a whole other discussion. In terms of free stuff, we aren't far apart on that, and that is that I don't necessarily agree with the part of no copay, because the low copay I think people can't afford. But there still is a problem, and the GOP has not stepped up with making sure if you're going to cover things like Viagra, that they ought to cover contraception too. Otherwise, leave them both out. Let them pay for theirs, and we'll pay for ours.
Okay. So whatever Rush Limbaugh's influence may be, we do have a dispute within among conservatives and within the Republican Party, as we have just heard. Now we have a liberal voice, Katha Pollitt, who is a columnist for The Nation magazine. Katha Pollitt, good to have you on our program.
Oh, hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
First of all, is there anything worse about what Rush Limbaugh said than what Ed Schultz and Bill Maher have said about conservative women on the other side?
Well, you know, I just want to say that a lot of left-wing women and liberal women and feminist women have gone after these liberal men. Which is not the case on the other side. And Ed Schultz, I was furious at him when he said that. And he did apologize at great length. He called Laura Ingraham. He, I think, has really tried to amend his ways on his program. He's had a lot of women on. Bill Maher, I really have big problems with because he does say things that I find quite unacceptable. But, you know, I don't – Bill Maher is not a major voice in national politics, and neither is Ed Schultz, unfortunately. Rush Limbaugh is a huge, big deal. Rush Limbaugh was broadcasting from the Capitol at the behest of the Republican Party. I mean, if they're just not really comparable, and that's why you found that the two, you know, that the Republican presidential candidates, who I'm sure were quite appalled by what was said about Sandra Fluke, just really couldn't, you know, come right out and say it. Now, you didn't. I want to say two things. One is you didn't mention the worst thing that Rush said, which was, so, Miss Fluke and the rest of you feminazis, here's the deal. If we're going to pay for your contraceptives and thus pay for you to have sex, we want something. We want you to post the videos online so we can all watch. So, in other words, Rush is kind of admitting that he's a porn consumer and that he broadcasts to other porn consumers and that the taxpayer is a porn consumer. Well, that's kind of amazing, isn't it? Nobody's sort of picked up on that yet. The other thing I want to say is to Mona, which is Mona Charon, which is I'm looking now at 5 pages of covered preventive services under the Affordable Care Act, this, you know, of which cancer medication is not a preventive service. This is blood pressure screening, it's immunizations, it's type 2 diabetes screening, it's HIV screening, breast cancer chemo, prevention counseling for women at higher risk, all kinds of things that I've never even heard of, hepatitis B screening for pregnant women at their first prenatal business. It's the birth control stuff is part of a package of preventative care that is quite long and quite great. And are we going to say, you know, you should be able to get your own immunization vaccines for hepatitis A, B, herpes zoster, human papillomavirus, influenza, measles, mumps, and rubella? Why should the government be buying you this? No, it's only when it's birth control that this argument is made. I think perhaps as a stalking horse for the fact that most of the people who are against the birth control coverage are against the entire Affordable Care Act. This is just something they think is going to be popular to fight. And they're wrong. And that was the big surprise because women not only use birth control, but birth control is a regular part of health care. And that's what this is all about.
So, Mona Charon, Rush on the question of pornography and the health care bill being cherry-picked by Republicans for political reasons. Go ahead.
I would say to Kath Pollitt that I don't think the government should be paying for any of this, okay? I think that a sensible solution to our health care would involve a huge overhaul of the way we cover things, and it wouldn't be people in elected positions picking and choosing who gets what kind of care. That's the politicization of a very personal matter that most of us would prefer that the government keep its hands out of. And if we had a sensible system, which I admit would involve, you know, sort of root and branch reform, taking away the tax deduction, for example, from employers and giving it to individuals and many, many other reforms, including, you know, stripping away the mandates that the states have imposed on insurance companies as well. It's state mandates that have driven up the cost of a basic plan to stratospheric heights because now everything has to be covered. You have to cover IVF, you have to cover hair transplants, you have to cover eyeglasses, you have to cover psychiatric visits. All of these things states have layered on to what the average insurance plan has to provide.
So what about Rush Limbaugh and saying that he wanted to see videos of women having sex?
Rush Limbaugh apologized. It was not. It was a terrible thing to say. He apologized as he should. It was not quite as terrible, I would say, some of the things that those on the left have said, but they're all terrible, and they all deserve to be criticized for it. But again, I don't think this should be allowed to be to become just the, you know, Rush Limbaugh week in America. He's not that important. But what is important is the fight over what the Obama administration is attempting to do. This is just a small piece of what the Affordable Care Act is going to look like when it's fully implemented, which is that every decision about health care will now be political.
Okay. Katha Pollitt, will this discussion of Rush Limbaugh, do you think, help build support for the Affordable Care Act?
I think it's waking up a lot of women who have tended to feel that they were going to be protected, they're okay. Maybe, you know, poor women in Texas, 400,000 poor women in Texas are losing their access to reproductive health care because of, you know, defund Planned Parenthood and defund Title and get rid of Title IX and all that. And I think, you know, this is really waking people up to how far the, you know, what's being called the war on women has gone, and that there is a connection between let's not have birth control be covered by health insurance, and, you know, let's just call them all sluts and prostitutes.
So does Rush Limbaugh, from your standpoint, represent the Republican all Republicans, or is that an unfair accusation?
I'm sorry, I missed something. I thought you were talking to someone else. What?
No. Talking to you. Back to Rush Limbaugh. We have just a moment left, and I just want to ask if you think it's unfair to sully all Republicans by associating them with Rush Limbaugh.
Well, let them dissociate themselves then, which they haven't really done.
That's all the time we have. Katha Pollitt, again, columnist for The Nation. Thanks to you. Thanks to Mona Charon, syndicated columnist, contributor to the National Review Online. Ann Stone with Republicans for Choice. John Wilson, author of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, our earlier guest, and Jim Rennie, our earlier guest as well, media writer for The Los Angeles Times. Good to have all of you on our program. The FBI says it's trying to repair relationships with Muslims in New Jersey after reports that the New York police have conducted surveillance on Muslims well outside the city. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, has suggested that the police are going too far. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Foreman, I'll be back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the city devastated on September 11th, there was broad support for preparation against another attack. The Associated Press has been reporting that the New York Police Department has gone far afield and that it's building databases on Muslim life for a radius of 100 or 200 miles from the city. Adam Goldman is one of four investigative reporters for the Associated Press who broke this story. And Adam Goldman, it's good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you. First of all, will you tell us a bit about just how extensive this surveillance is?
Well, this surveillance touched almost every aspect of Muslim life in New York City and stretched into neighboring states such as New Jersey. The NYPD, using its secretive demographics unit, a unit that the NYPD denied even existed before we published the documents, used rakers, undercover officers, to go into ethnic neighborhoods and rake for trouble spots, rake the coals, as they say in the NYPD. And they went to cafes, they went to businesses, and cataloged what the daily routine of Muslims.
Did they, in this process, have any presumption or any evidence in advance that the people they were surveilling might, in fact, have had something to do, something in mind, or might have been associated with alleged terrorists?
No. As far as we could tell, the association was they were Muslim. And that seemed to be the indicator for going into these neighborhoods. We've published many secret NYPD reports about their activities, and in these reports, the demographics reports where they went into these neighborhoods, the Moroccan neighborhoods, Egyptians, Syrians, Albanians, there was no criminal activity listed.
No criminal activity at all. What about student groups?
Well, the NYPD believe that they needed to track these student groups because terrorists had, in fact, been associated with Muslim student activities organizations. So the NYPD made the leap that since someone had, you know, been a terrorist and been involved in one of these groups, thus they needed to monitor all the groups.
New Jersey officials have been complaining about this.
Yeah, they're really, really angry. Cory Booker, Governor Christie, the NYPD went to Newark. They reached out to the Newark Police Department and said, we need to go over there. We have a quote-unquote terrorist. They had a criminal lead or some still unexplained terrorist threat, and they used that as a reason to document all of Muslim life in Newark. And the Newark police chief, the authorities there said that while the NYPD said they were coming over and they knew that, they didn't know exactly. They didn't know what they were doing, and they didn't know they were going to catalog all of Muslim life, mosques, businesses, anything essentially affiliated with Muslims.
How long has this been going on, just since September 11th?
At, well, 2002, the NYPD formed what is known as the Intelligence Division. It's run by a man by the name of David Cohen. Cohen was a former top CIA officer. So they brought Cohen over to gather intelligence. And that's what the CIA does abroad. They gather intelligence, but they don't use that intelligence to build cases.
They rake, to use your term.
They rake, right.
Here's what Mayor Bloomberg has had to say, the mayor of the city of New York.
Everything the New York City Police Department has done is legal. It is appropriate. It is constitutional. They are permitted to travel beyond the borders of New York City to investigate cases. We don't target individuals based on race or religion.
Adam Goldman, there are those, obviously, who disagree with what the mayor has to say. The newspapers within New York, the Daily News, the Post, and others, however, have been very supportive.
Yes. Well, the tabloids, of course, have been very supportive. The New York Times wrote a very critical editorial a week ago. You know, the battle lines are drawn, right? I mean, this isn't any different than waterboarding or extraordinary rendition or EITs or warrantless wiretapping, right? They're always drawn along these political lines. We have only asked that people go to our website, you know, www.ap.org/NYPD, and read the documents for yourself.
So is this, then, according to your information, still happening?
We're trying to get a handle on what exactly they're doing right now. And, you know, once we find that out, we'll be sure to let New Yorkers know.
It's my understanding the CIA did some investigation about whether they broke the law by cooperating with the NYPD. You say there was a top CIA guy working for the police department. Has the CIA actually been involved?
Well, let me tell you what happened. After 9/11, Dave Cohen, who had retired from the CIA, went over to run this intelligence division. And they brought over a man by the name of Larry Sanchez, a CIA officer, to work hand-in-hand with Cohen. And it was Sanchez who built these programs, the demographics unit, the rakers. And it was all modeled. This has sort of gotten lost in the discussion. But, you know, the NYPD's intelligence division was modeled. Their activities in the neighborhoods were modeled after the Israelis and what the Israelis did in occupied territories, especially in the West Bank. Now, once we reported our story, the CIA's inspector general, who was appointed by the president, launched an internal investigation. And the CIA found that they didn't break any laws, and this is the way they parse it, because we didn't tell Larry Sanchez to do any of this. He wasn't under the direction of the CIA, even though he was on the CIA payroll.
Pretty indirect. So you mentioned Governor Christie of New Jersey, a Republican, of course, very angry about all this. What has he any intention of taking some sort of action? And what about local Muslim groups?
It's unclear what Christie is going to do. Just today, Holder, Attorney General Holder, made some comments in front of Congress. He had apparently had run into Christie, and he said he was disturbed by what he has read in the media. Holder, the Attorney General, said.
He was disturbed at this point. Now, there's also been a demonstration of Muslims in support of the New York police, I understand.
Yeah, there were a small number of Muslims, two dozen, three dozen Muslims who came out in support of the NYPD, along with Representative Peter King, who's a hard and fast supporter of the NYPD's policies. you know, but the counterpoint to that is, you know, the Muslims themselves, with hundreds of Muslims, have come out and rallied. And one of the people who helped, who was pivotal and part of this group that rallied in support of the NYPD was an individual who had narrated this controversial video called The Third Jihad that the NYPD had shown to its officers, and thus it's the only thing the NYPD has apologized for, including Bloomberg. It was inappropriate.
All right. An extraordinary series of stories by the Associated Press. Obviously more to come from what we've heard from Adam Goldman. Again, one of four investigative reporters for the AP who discovered this story. Thanks a lot for being on our program. Come back. Hey, talk to us some more.
Thanks for having us. Bye.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Caitlin Schamberg and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.